The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. It's not Ben Maxwell, although he will be coming up shortly. It's me, Scott McIntyre, for some reason, in the host chair after I demanded to be put in such a position last time. So it's great to be here. Coming up on the show today, we will hear from Stuart Woodward for all things Yokohama F Marinos. We'll hear from a friend of mine and a friend of the show, of course, in Alex Bishop, a frequent contributor to the Indian press. Maybe we can get into that, as well as Ryan Steele from Australia about the boxing match that took place in the first leg of the Asian Champions League final. And of course, I might at some point bring in Mr. Benjamin Maxwell. The J-Talk Podcast starts soon.
It is a big welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Don't give up your day job, Scott.
That was my day job for a long time,
though. Indeed. A passable intro for your first attempt on this podcast. Anyway, you've got them pretty much down pat on the
Asian game. It was unscripted and unprompted. Well, it was prompted, but it was unscripted.
It most definitely was. But, a decent first crack at it on this podcast anyway. Yes, as you kind of got to in a roundabout way, we're leading off the show with Ryan Steele to talk about the first leg of the Asian Champions League final that took place in Japan time in the early hours of a Sunday morning and Adelaide time as well. Ryan, did you make it through the game and how many pots of coffee did you get through? Welcome back to the show as well.
Thanks for having me on again, Ben. It was incredibly early in Adelaide. It was a 3 o'clock kickoff in the morning. So, needless to say, I went through a few coffees that night. I took the leisure of having a bit of a sleep in after that.
Do not blame you at all, Scott. So do I need to welcome you into the podcast? I don't suppose I do, as you've led it off.
No, I've welcomed myself. I'm here. I was actually out with Alex on that night of the Champions League final. We were hopping around a few bars, getting up to a bit of mischief, and we actually ended up getting kicked out of one about 15 minutes into this game. So I saw that, and then I caught up with it a day or so later. And almost a physical confrontation that we got into at the bar was a pretty decent parallel for this game. I mean, Baftembe Gomis, the Al Hilal forward, 25, 30 minutes, he absolutely murdered pretty much half of the Urawa team, and he had a couple of mates doing the same thing with him. So it was pretty clear what Hilal were trying to do, and that was very much rattle Reds physically. We haven't seen that in the Champions League to this point. Urawa got a little bit of their own back as things went on. A few of the foreign boys, Ayrton in particular, decided to give as good as he got. But you'd have to say, okay, it was a decent result for Urawa. Overall, a narrow 1-0 loss on the road. They'll be confident, you think, of getting the job done back here. Hilal did have quite a few chances to score more goals than that. There were a couple of controversial handball calls that went against them as well. So perhaps slightly fortunate on the balance to escape with just the one goal defeat. But yeah, certainly reading the reaction from the players and coaching staff afterwards, they feel that it's a result that they can certainly better in the second leg. And, yeah, the way that they've been playing in Asia, you'd have to think it's set up quite nicely for them.
All right. So, yeah, as it was just the single goal for Al Hilal that came in the 60th minute through Andre Carrillo. The stats make for a pretty dire reading from a Reds perspective, Ryan. But I guess, yeah, in the face of this physical battering that they took throughout from Al Hilal, how do you feel? Was it kind of damage limitation towards the end, and did you feel relieved at the full time whistle that it was just a 1-0 defeat and certainly a deficit that Reds, as Scott says, Reds the players will feel they can overturn back in Saitama in 2 weeks?
Relief is the main word, because it could have easily have been 3 or 4 at the end of that night. The performance was just dire. I mean, it's the most J-League performance that we've seen from them this season, which I guess says a lot considering where they are in the J-League table. They were just on the back foot pretty much the entire time. They had maybe 2 chances, maybe 3 or 4 attacks in total into the final third. They were just being pummeled by the attacking power of Al Hilal. And, you know, to escape with just 1-0 does make that return leg in Saitama a much bigger deal. You know, the performance is going to be critical, and to have that 2-week rest, which we talked about with Paul a couple of weeks ago now. That 2-week break is just going to be so big in terms of adjusting their game plan, because it just didn't work in this first leg. You know, they wanted to sit back and they wanted to counter, and they just didn't have enough chances. They were just always on the back foot. They hardly had any possession. I think it was about 70% in the end. I know after the first 25 minutes, it was 78% to Al Hilal. And you know, the amount of chances that they created, you know, you could really say that the inclusion of Fukushima into the starting 11, as the goalkeeper for this, since Nishikawa was suspended for the match, was really critical, because he actually had a good game, for a less experienced player, someone without that freshness that, or, I suppose game preparedness that, that Nishikawa has. He did really well. He stopped a couple of chances, and yeah, it could have been much more devastating. So yeah, relief is definitely the key word for this one.
And Scott, on the monolithic ACL final preview that you did on the Asian Game podcast, I think it's fair to say you were the most pessimistic about Reds' chances, at least in the first leg, and perhaps the tie overall. So, yeah, as Ryan said, this was the most J-League performance, the most J1 performance they put in Asia pretty much this whole season. So, yeah, did you feel this was some J1 chickens coming home to roost, if you like, for Reds? Or were they just completely taken aback from the start, as you say, by this physical barrage that Al Hilal subjected them to?
Well, my prediction for the first leg got lost on the cutting room floor at the end of that episode, but I did predict a 2-0 win for Al Hilal, so I wasn't too far off. But I think you look at, the game in a way went as we expected, right? I mean, Hilal have a very porous defense, but they have a brilliant attack with some fine foreign players and some very good Saudi internationals as well. We know that Reds are quite limited in their attacking capabilities, but conversely are well-structured and organized. Certainly in the ACL, they have been defensively in being able to limit some of these other dangerous teams, you know, the likes of Shanghai International Port Group and Guangzhou that they played to get through to the final. So we expected certainly the first leg to unfold in the manner it did, and I think really from Reds' perspective, they'll be very happy really with the result, because you look at the chances. I agree with what Ryan said. Fukushima was actually very good throughout. Of course, he did. I mean, it was his really poor positioning on the cross that cost him the goal. So you can say, okay, it's not great because he's directly cost him one goal, but he did make late in the first half, a couple of quite impressive saves. But you know, I mean, someone like Takuya Aoki coming back, whether he was fully fit or not, we don't know. But he also made a crucial goal line clearance. I think it was around the half hour mark as well. So I think on balance, Reds did very well. They didn't necessarily limit the chances, but they limited the scoring, and that was always going to be the aim. We know now it's a clean break for Reds, because they've had all these league matches rescheduled, so they don't have any fixtures to worry about in these 2 weeks. I don't know if Yuki Muto is going to be fit or not for the second leg, but he's probably the only concern for them. Of course, Nishikawa coming back into the lineup, and then Hilal must travel here with, you know, the weight and the pressure. Certainly this match, I don't know if we can say means more, but it's covered far more extensively in the Saudi press than it is in the Japanese press, you know, where you might get a couple of stories here or there, you know, in the days prior. But this is the living and breathing moment of not Saudi society, but certainly a Saudi sporting society, and it has been for a very long time. So it means a huge amount to the team, and you know, by extension of that, to the nation as well. So there's huge pressure I think on Hilal, you know, to come here now and get the job done, and we've seen before teams from West Asia kind of wilt under that pressure. I think really everything is set up perfectly for Reds to go into the second leg and be able to get the job done. You know, perhaps okay, the away goals thing could come into it if Hilal did score first, then you know, it's not so easy. But we know both domestically and certainly in the ACL that Reds have been a very hard team to break down. They're very well structured defensively, and back at home, freshly rested in front of a big crowd, I think I might change my mind you in a couple of weeks, but I think as it's set up now, I think they're very well placed to go and finish the job.
All right, well, I'm sure that's music to your ears, Ryan. How are you feeling about things? Obviously there is quite a decent break for Reds to dust themselves off and hopefully not overthink things, but yeah, hopefully the muscle memory of what they've been able to do in the ACL, both of course in 2017 when they won it, and what's taken them all the way to the final this year will kick in, and yeah, in 2 weeks they'll put on their best performance. As Scott says, if Al Hilal can manage a goal, they'll obviously need three, but it should certainly be a cracking atmosphere at Saitama Stadium, and well, yeah, all they've got to do now is go for it. Although I'm sure they'll approach it with an element of caution from the start. But yeah, once they find their footing in the game, they'll really look to, drive home their home advantage, as Al Hilal have done in the first leg.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely important. As you said, if Al Hilal do score, then it's big pressure on Urawa to score three goals, and I'm not entirely sure that they have that in them, let alone even having two to secure a win at home. The important thing is that they go to Saitama, they use that home advantage, the much bigger crowd, because it's at least going to be, I imagine it's going to be at least twice the crowd, that's possible, from the first leg, in a 25,000 seat stadium at King Saud. They take that and attack. You know, they need to score. They need to put themselves on the front foot in this game. They can't just be sitting back and trying to absorb attack of these brilliant players. It's just every player that was attacking for Al Hilal had a pretty decent game actually. And they can't take that risk again. They need to be in better control of this game, and they really need to attack. They need to score. Probably get themselves on the score sheet in the first half just to put some pressure on Al Hilal and open them up again for the second half and really take it to them. Because yeah, like I said, I don't think they've got three goals in them. So to ask two is still a bit of a stretch, given their record recently. But at the same time, that's the best chance that we've got. And that's something that they need to take into account. And Otsky really needs to make the most of this opportunity of having only gone down 1-0 in the first half.
I think a lot of the second leg is, you might be doing a pot about this beforehand, but I think it's going to, more than how Reds play, I think it's going to come down to what Al Hilal do, because as I said before, they have this brilliant attack, but they have a very, very sketchy defence. So you would imagine from their point of view, coming and trying to sit on that 1-0 first leg advantage is not going to be the most advisable course of action for them. But equally so, if they did push high up the pitch early on and try to grab the away goal to really turn the tide of things, that exactly plays into the way that Reds want them to play, which is drawing them out and then being able to strike on the counter. And we've seen, particularly in Asia, the damage that the two wide, whatever you call them, wing-backs, full-backs, wide midfielders in Hashioka on the right and Sekine on the left, who've been a really important outlet for them in executing those kind of counter-attacking situations. And then, of course, you've got the late runs coming from Fabrizio and Nagasawa in the central areas, and the really brilliant presence of Kuroki as well. So yeah, I think it's going to be determined how Hilal approach it. Personally, I can't think that they would come here and and try and sit on the advantage, which, it could really play ideally into Reds' hands in giving them that outlet to goal, because they're not the kind of team that are going to apply constant pressure in advanced areas and maintain possession high up the pitch and slowly, prod and probe and find their way to breakthroughs. This is not really the way that Urawa have been at their best in Asia. So, I don't think there'll be much different tactically from Urawa, but a lot of it will be what Hilal do and then how Reds react to that.
I honestly don't think that Al Hilal really have it in them to sit back anyway. I think they acknowledge that their strong point is the attack and that they're going to try to take every team to the sword every time they play. I would probably be anticipating that second leg to be played out in a very similar way as the first leg. I can't see them having the capability to sit back and defend. I think they'd have too many itchy feet to be wanting to run forward and have the ball in the attacking third.
All right. Well, it's going to be fascinating, obviously, in 2 weeks' time, Saitama Stadium on the 24th of November. All right, Ryan, we won't bring you down by mentioning Reds' performance in their three league games that they played that were obviously front-loaded before this ACL first leg. But I tell you what, I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. I think that point away at Hiroshima in the first of those three games that were brought forward before the first leg, that might just prove to be the difference, because obviously with, and I don't want to jinx anything, Shonan and Matsumoto struggling for wins in a mighty fashion at the moment. Reds having 36 points at the moment and being 5 clear of Shonan and 6 of Matsumoto, that might just be enough with those teams having 3 games left to play, and Reds, of course, just 2 once the final is complete away at FC Tokyo and then home against Gumba on the final day. But that's obviously all to come in the future. We wish Reds all the very best in the second leg, go and do it just like you did in 2017.
I'll be eagerly awaiting the next 2 weeks for the second leg, and I'll be very thankful that I won't have to stay up so late for this one.
Most definitely. All right, thank you very much to Ryan Steele. After a quick hit of music, Scott and I will chat with Alex Bishop about tabletopping FC Tokyo. Welcome back, and it's time to welcome back to JTalk a certain Alex Bishop. Alex, how are you? It's been quite a little while.
I'm very well, thanks, Ben. It has been a little bit of a while indeed. I'm just recovering from the weekend, but otherwise, I'm grand.
It's been a couple of significant endings in the last week or so, Alex. Of course, the Rugby World Cup wrapped up. I know you were busy with taking care of that, and I know Scott's devastated that particular tournament has a finished. Mm-hmm. And also this past Saturday, FC Tokyo's epic 8-game road trip wrapped up, and we're going to come on to events at the Yamaha Stadium very, very shortly. But yes, you headed down there, and Tokyo have ended up smelling like roses, I suppose, haven't they, after such an extended period away from Ajinomoto Stadium?
Yeah, they have. Yeah, I mean, the important thing to remember is we started the eight away game road trip top of the table, and we've come back to Ajinomoto still top. So I think anyone would have taken that going into this long stint. Smelling of roses is maybe a little bit over optimistic, but definitely very positive.
Most definitely. All right, well, we'll do a little bit of housekeeping before we get to events at the Yamaha Stadium on Saturday afternoon. I very kindly didn't mention to Ryan in part one about Urawa's home game against Kawasaki last Tuesday. That was their match day 32 fixture that was brought forward, obviously, before the ACL final first leg. Frontale headed up to Saitama Stadium, where they had won the Levain Cup last month, of course. Frontale won 2-0 thanks to goals from Yasuto Wakisaka and Yu Kobayashi. And then Frontale did FC Tokyo and Yokohama a massive favour on Saturday afternoon, Scott. Kawasaki on the road again, headed up to leaders Kashima and returned home with all 3 points after winning by the same scoreline. They have beaten Kashima Antlers 2-0. The goals coming in the second half, the first from ex-Kashima man Kazuya Yamamura and the second from Tatsuya Hasegawa. So, I don't think, Scott, that anybody who had their eye on the J1 title race were expecting Antlers to blink first, but that is what has taken place. Was this a matter of, Antlers feeling the pressure, or were Kawasaki just that good, or did they just take their chances when they presented themselves?
It's a mixture of all three, but I think it's worth pointing out that we have said fairly consistently over the last month or two on the podcast that there were really questions with Kashima over the sheer weight of matches that they've played almost non-stop for 3 years, and whether directly or indirectly the players that they've consistently been losing to injury throughout that. They've done fantastically well, to balance things. But as I've said time and time again, this is a squad that basically hasn't had a break when you factor in the end of season Club World Cup, a lot of them for 3 years. So at some point, logic suggests that that has to catch up to them. It has certainly hurt them, with the injury situation. They got Serginho back for this game, which was a helper. They had Kento Misao back for a game, and now he's out again. They've lost, various other kind of squad options, or depth options off the bench as well. We only saw the online that youngster, what's his name, the Nagoya guy, Soma, come back as well. So, they've had to deal with this constant chopping and changing of lineups through, through injury as well. But for the first 45 minutes here, this was an absolutely disastrous match. Really, almost nothing of any kind of note whatsoever outside of a moment late in the half from Yamamura, who almost scored an own goal. And then even, things picked up for the first 15 minutes after the restart. But that was all Kashima, in increased pressure and a couple of chances. And then, boom, it's all punctured from a free kick. Yamamura's headed home from that, and that's kind of taken the wind out of Kashima. Then they've gone and got another. The substitute, the Hasegawa's come on, and Kobayashi's shot's kind of cannon back off the off the post, and he's tapped it home. But I don't think the result was necessarily if you look on paper, 2-0 win, you think maybe Kawasaki had control away from home. That wasn't the case. It was very close, and up until the goal, Kashima were the better of the two teams. So yeah, it's certainly a result though that's had a big impact at the top of the table. I don't know if it's mathematically possible for Kawasaki to go on and win from here or not. Do we know that? Have you crunched your numbers with all these teams playing each other?
I think it's barely possible, right? Because you've got the Kanagawa derby coming up. If they win that, then and other results go their way, I think it is mathematically possible.
I think it's more the last match, right? Because they're those two teams. Anyway, they're not going to go on and win the title win thing. But they've certainly done a big favour for both Tokyo and Marinos. And if you look at momentum, there's no question who the form team is and the team that should really go on and win it. And that's Marinos. And I know from speaking to people close to the situation that they're absolutely over the moon now with all these results, because what they said to me is it's in our hands now. And it absolutely is, because they play each other on the last match of the season. So on form and momentum, Yokohama are the team. And the way that the schedule's worked out as well. So they're certainly the team to beat. And from here, I can't really see Kashima finding a way back, because, just this constant, fatigue and the lack of plays is finally catching up to them. And it's not beyond the pale that they might not even finish third, depending on what else transpires in these other matches as well. So, yeah, certainly a great result for the top two. And you would think in some order that's the way that the top two is going to be, come 3 weeks from now.
All right then. So yes, a first loss in 10 for Antlers, and Kawasaki are now 5 unbeaten in the league, and they've won 3 straight in J1 since their Levain Cup triumph over Sapporo, of course. So yes, it was interesting, Alex, with the top three all kicking off at the same time at 2 o'clock on Saturday. That hasn't happened in the last few match days. I don't think any of them have played at the same time for quite a few weeks now. So, yeah, it was really interesting to be watching the Tokyo game live, and I didn't want to check the other two games because I didn't want to jinx them. And, I can't say I was shocked when I saw that Kawasaki had won, but very obviously very, very pleasantly surprised. But, yes, you were otherwise occupied down at the Yamaha Stadium. A large contingent of away supporters made the trip, as is the case always with FC Tokyo, of course. Very good travellers. So, yeah, how was the atmosphere in the away end throughout the day? It was obviously a beautiful day on Saturday, so I'm sure you very much enjoyed yourself. And, probably the first game you'd gotten to in quite a while since the rugby had wrapped up.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, they did go down to Kobe. I think it was a couple of weeks ago now, 3 weeks ago. But it was the first away game for a while, Kobe and Iwata. And yeah, the atmosphere was great. You know, terrific. It was, it kind of with this big long away game stint, this was kind of like the final one. So I think everybody felt that they had to get down there and cheer the boys on. Beer was flowing. You know, the sunshine was out, which was a bit of a surprise. So I packed probably the warmest jacket I've got. Had to leave that one in the car. And went out with the old away kit on. Everyone was in full voice. Really important game. I had this one down as one of the more difficult ones, actually. One of the more difficult away games that we had, because they always kind of, we don't really have a good history playing Iwata. They play very tight and compact usually, and it's usually like a 0-0, 1-0 to them, or maybe 1-0 to us, this kind of thing. So it was kind of one of the more difficult ones, I thought. I think, you know, next week against Shonan, we won't have much of a problem against them, and maybe even Reds as well. But that could be a little bit touch and go. It was good. To be honest, we should have lost the game probably. We probably didn't deserve to win, I don't think, with a kind of dubious penalty. They should have probably had a goal as well. That one that kind of looked like it crossed the line, and maybe a goal line technology would have ruled that one out. Who knows? But otherwise, no, it was good to get the points. One of these difficult games, we still managed to somehow muster up the points, and hopefully we can keep eking out these wins till the end of the season. But bar the actual football and the lack of real chances on the pitch, it was a great day out.
Yeah, I mean, they don't tend to be great games, do they? Games between these two teams, and especially with Iwata having so much on the line. I guess, yeah, it was a very much a banana skin for Tokyo, with just beaten Kobe and Oita in the previous two league games, the two teams that really had nothing left to play for, while Iwata were scrapping for their very lives in the top flight. And this loss might have been their death knell. But I don't know, Scott. They certainly tried to make the pitch as wide as possible. Dialton was just stationed out on the left touchline as much as possible. But apart from the odd flash from him, he wasn't really able to link up with Lukian, and the threat that he'd posed in recent weeks. He scored a couple of really important late goals for Iwata. He was somewhat neutralised, I felt.
Yeah, well, he's been neutralised by the barbecues that he's been at as well. He's a big boy these days, Dalton. Certainly not as dynamic as he was when he first came to Japanese football. I'm not so really convinced either about this, Lukian, either, since he's come. He hasn't done much. The young guy that they brought in since the new coach has come in, Fujikawa, was shifted from where he's played more centrally in recent weeks out to a more kind of wide role on the left. I'm not sure if that worked either. And I'm still not sure what's going on, why Kaminsky is in the bad books either, with Hata getting the nod here again. But I concur with what Alex said. Yet again, this was another match where Tokyo had less chances, they had less possession, and the amount of times they've won from whether it's a corner, a free kick, a penalty, it's a penalty here. They take the result and still, I can't believe that this, that they've managed to do this, so consistently, these narrow wins from set piece, kind of situations where they've been, outplayed and certainly, that's been reflected in the stats sheets in pretty much our most games, throughout the season. That's not, we've been through it a million times. It's not the way that I like these teams to play. So, maybe at the end of the year they get a star on the badge, but it's not it's not creating, I don't think, a sustained ideology for the club. Maybe you win one here, you win one again, you know, in 10 years' time playing in a different way, but it's not the philosophy that I personally build clubs. We've been through, well, would look to build clubs. This is, you know, we've been through it a billion times. And if, as it appears, is going to be the case, it comes down to the final match of the season. It's such a great assessment of these vastly different philosophies between this reactive Tokyo team and a proactive Marinos one. So yeah, it's going to be a fascinating situation. I really hope it does come down to that as well. You know, even you know, if Marinos are still a point behind and they need to win to get over Tokyo, it's going to be, yeah, really a crystallization of the footballing philosophies of both clubs. Certainly a little bit harsh here on Jubilo. I wonder if I mean, they have in the last couple of weeks been a little bit better. The squad is still quite limited. I'm not sure that this coach is the right guy, but you know, at least they've been putting up you know, a real fight to try and find their way out of this situation. And as poor as a couple of these teams are above them, you never know, they might somehow find a way to go on a run and reel off three wins and, you know, maybe do what we didn't think was possible. But this was certainly, yeah, a loss that they probably couldn't have afforded to take. One that's done Tokyo wonders in terms of taking them back to the top of the table, but really not a great example of any kind of outstanding football.
Indeed, indeed. So we'll wrap it up. It was almost a year to the day since these two played out a 0-0 draw at Ajinomoto Stadium in match day 32 last year. Guys, I don't know if you remember, that game was pretty much a nothing event as well, but it really only had one major talking point, and that was Diego Oliveira's first half penalty miss after Sei Miroya was fouled inside the box. Well, this time round, history repeated, but with one exception. Oliveira's ridiculous stuttery penalty run-up routine actually paid off as he froze Naoki Hata and stuck his spot kick away 8 minutes into the second half. So, yeah, Miroya was tripped in pretty much identical circumstances after cutting back, after getting to the byline. Last year, Oliveira fluffed his lines, but this time, he was lucky Kaminsky wasn't in goal, because I'm sure Kaminsky can read him like a book. But anyway, Oliveira's penalty. And then he went off with a hamstring injury with about 10 minutes to go, guys. Now, I don't know if you caught this. He was having a bit of a joke with Mori Shige and Takahagi at the full-time whistle. So I don't know whether it was actually time for him to be subbed off and he decided to fake a hamstring injury to waste a couple more minutes, or whether he actually might be in trouble of missing the next league game against Shonan in 2 weeks' time. Scott, has that popped up on any of your injury report websites yet?
No, not that I've seen. And you think even if it's a minor thing, the fact that he's got the extra week to get over it wouldn't be too much of an issue. And South Americans are wasting time late on. It's all par for the course.
Indeed, indeed. All right, well, Alex, we'll wrap it up with this. And, we've mentioned the end of the 8-game road trip. When it began, FC Tokyo were 4 points clear at the top of the table. They've won their last three to bring them on to a total of 14 points earned out of 24 available. So they've won four, drawn two, and lost two in this run of 8 games. So they've really only they've lost a point in terms of their advantage over Kashima, but of course Yokohama have caught up in a fairly significant measure as they're on an excellent run of form. But considering this run of 8 straight away games is basically unprecedented in world football, how do you think they've managed it? And I think for me, 14 points out of 24 available, and considering they're robbed out of one down in Tosu, is a pretty decent score. It's slightly above par for me. How do you rate it?
We did do a thing about this on Twitter, I think, just before it all, before we went on the 8-game road trip. And I think I put them at something like 15, something pretty close. But yeah, I would have taken it. 14 points, I'd have definitely taken that at the beginning.
You echo those thoughts, Scott? I mean, I know you don't like, you're not a huge fan of the football that they've played, pretty much the entire season, let alone this 8-game road trip. But how do you think they've managed it, all things considered?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of it at all. Just looking at it in terms of points earned and results, I think you've got to say it's a fantastic achievement to have been able to secure as many points as I had. And as both you guys said, you know, if you you wouldn't have thought when they started it that they would have still been on top of the table. So, yeah, to be in that position and to be able to give themselves a real shot with three matches to go is Yeah. Just in terms of the pure results, it's a fantastic achievement.
It is indeed. So we're going to come on and talk about Yokohama with Stuart Woodward in just a moment. But yes, for Tokyo and Kashima are left to play. Tokyo have Shonan and Urawa at home, two straight at home before they visit Yokohama on the final day of the season, while Kashima are away at Hiroshima in 2 weeks' time in match day 32. They host Kobe in their final home game of the season before visiting Nagoya on the final day. And we'll obviously talk about how huge Yokohama's run-in is with Stuart very, very shortly. But for now, Alex, we will leave it there. It's been great to catch up again. Great to hear that you had such a good day down in Iwata, and then it obviously continued with Scott once you returned to the metropolis. And yeah, I'm sure you and the guys at FC Tokyo English on Twitter will be all over the last three match days of the season.
We will indeed, yeah, we will indeed. We've been scrambling for tickets for that last one for the Marinos penultimate match. But yeah, we'll be there in full voice, Shonan, Urawa, and Yokohama as well.
I'll tell you what, if you get a line on any tickets for the Yokohama game, pop me a message, because I'm scrambling for one, and I'm looking for a plus one for Graham as well. So yeah, keep me posted. Yeah.
Well, indeed, mate. There might be a little bit of an extra, a bit of a premium on it, but you know...
It's got to be done. It's got to be done. Completely understand, Alex. All right, well, thank you very much. And, yeah, look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Cheers. Thanks very much, Ben. Great speaking with you.
All right, then. After another quick hit of music, we'll be back with Stuart Woodward. Next, it's my great pleasure to welcome Stuart Woodward back to the podcast. Stuart, how are you?
Oh, very well, thank you.
I'm sure you are, after a very fruitful Saturday afternoon for your Yokohama F. Marinos side. Saw them rise to second in the table, like FC Tokyo moving above Kashima Antlers after their loss at home to Kawasaki. It was quite a day at Mitsuzawa, of course, your last home game of the season there before you return to the Nissan Stadium on the final day when you host FC Tokyo. A lot of football to be played before then, of course, and we're here to talk about your 4-2 win over Sapporo. FC Tokyo had cornered the market on fast starts in the past two match days, Stuart, but Yokohama more than one-upped them with the Eric scoring twice in the first 4 minutes. You probably hadn't even had time to settle into your seat.
Well, certainly the first goal, you know, was a real, well, pleasant surprise. I think I was just almost on the minute mark when Eric managed to steal the ball back from a back pass and actually got it in the goal. Like, I think he's a really, you know, great, accurate player, and just a sort of person that, we want to, okay, we've been prone to losing a goal in the first minute or the first 5 minutes in a similar way in the past. So that one came as a real happy surprise, and then I could hardly believe that we had another goal in within two more minutes. So with that one, Nakagawa managing to save a very deep pass from the halfway line, and just managed to catch it on the goal line, dribbled into the box, lost possession, got it back, and crossed to Eric, who headed it in with almost the back of his head for the second goal. So at that point, we were really, celebrating. I think one of the beers went flying in the air at that point, and it was quite unbelievable. To be two ahead in the fourth minute. So yes, we were really, really happy with that. And actually, one of our friends, friend of the podcast too, who will remain nameless, was 10 minutes late and missed three goals.
Oh no, you wouldn't read about it. Okay. Before we move on, Scott, we've talked about Consadole keeper Gu Sung-yun on a few occasions. We don't want to cast any aspersions, but the first goal in particular, when he was robbed of the ball by Eric, fair play to Eric. I mean, he was Johnny on the spot, and he took the ball off Goosung Yung's toes 30 yards from goal. Is this one of these instances where we think, or as I say, we don't want to cast aspersions, that Gu might money have F. Marino's title win? I can't be done for libel by making incomplete sentences.
No. Yeah. This guy is a Korean international goalkeeper who is frequently called up to the Korean national team. Korea is a nation that produces very good goalkeepers. He 8 out of every 10 games is a very, very, very good goalkeeper, one of the better goalkeepers, and not just in the J-League, but anywhere in Asia. Those other two games, he makes mistakes that you or I wouldn't make if we were trying. So people can fill in the dots what's going on there. It's certainly very puzzling how 80 or 90% of the time he's one of the best goalkeepers in the league, and on the other 10% of occasions, certainly there's nothing left to ride on Sapporo's season here. As a side note of that, how you can be so dire. I'm not sure what the reason is, but maybe smarter people than me can and perhaps will figure it out one day.
Yes, indeed. Well, his Consadole Sapporo teammates did manage to get a goal back. As Stuart said, his friend missed the third goal of the match, and Musashi Suzuki scoring in the 8th minute to cut Sapporo's deficit to 2-1. But, Teruhito Nakagawa, who, as Stuart has mentioned as well, crossed for Eric's second goal. He made it 3-1 in the 23rd minute after he dribbled from halfway and rounded Gu. Not casting any aspersions on Gu racing off his line there. But anyway, yeah, terrific for Nakagawa. His phenomenal season continues. I know where the last time I think the three of us convened, you mentioned, Scott, that perhaps people behind the scenes at Yokohama were at times disappointed that Nakagawa hadn't done more with some of the opportunities that he'd had this season. On this occasion, he had an assist and a goal. Do you think that will have satisfied the coaching staff at F. Marinos?
Well, I think they're And certainly listening to the post-match comments from Ange, you know, as satisfying as the win was and the goals, there was a lot left out on the pitch as well. They could have had another legitimately 4 or 5 goals. And I think that's the frustration, not just with Nakagawa, but certainly with Eric and a couple of other players at the club as well, is that they are creating so many chances. And it sounds a little bit ridiculous or greedy or something, but the reality is that they weren't as clinical as they could have been. And you don't need to win every game by 7 or 8 goals, but also if you are creating that many chances, you do need to be a little bit ruthless and even more efficient in converting them. And this was one of those many games where Marinos could and probably should have scored, 7 or 8 at least. I know that this staff is constantly searching not just for good performances, not just for great performances, but for something approaching perfection. And if that's the way that you approach every session that you do, whether that be on the pitch, whether it be in the film room, and certainly what you do come match day as well, where you demand excellence. You don't just want results for results' sake. You want to make a stylistic argument and really leave an imprint on the grand scope of Japanese football. Then, if there's games that you should be winning by 7 or 8 goals, then you should be winning them by 7 or 8 goals. And there were certainly several culprits, for the fact that they didn't win by, in my opinion, and I think the coaching staff's opinion as heavily as they should have.
Indeed, indeed. Well, F. Marinos weren't finished on the day, and Marcos Jr. made it 4-1 in the 70th minute, maintaining his golden boot lead. He scored from the penalty spot after he was hauled down by Akito Fukumori. And then Musashi Suzuki got his second of the afternoon, 4 minutes later, to apply a measure of respectability to the scoreline. But yet, obviously, it could have been many more for F. Marinos on the day, and your side is in a really rich vein of form, Stuart. That must be especially pleasing for you. And obviously, we found out in the last day or so that the good times will continue to roll with Ange Postecoglou signing on the dotted line for the 2020 season as well. I'm sure that has really pleased all of the F. Marinos support, especially as there were rumours of flying around, and some of them were started on this very podcast by the man you're guesting with this week, Stuart, that Ange might have been off at the end of this year, but to have him locked down for another season must be very, very pleasing.
Yes, I think as soon as that news came out this morning, we've got a little chat going for my friends in the group who are near and far away. And as soon as that news came out, they let us all know that. And that was the topic of discussion this morning when we probably should have been working. It was just going around about that. But going back, right to the very first interview, I think the very first team get together when they have the presentation, the uniforms and the pitches. And at that time, the new manager, when Angie just first arrived in Japan, he made a very bold statement. Like at that time, it's like he said, I want F. Marinos to be a team that other teams fear to play. And he very much in his introduction there was making that statement. And we really didn't know what he meant at that time now. But as Scott said, that when the second goal went in and then the third goal, I just said to my friends, this could be one of those matches where it is 8 goals. Definitely, Sapporo still had fight in them, and it could have been 4-4. Like if they had some good shots on goal, half the shots on goal compared to Marinos. But it's one of those where playing such attacking football as Angie promised, you really need to be able to get well ahead to defend your lead, because they're not going to pass the ball back to the goalkeeper 100 times in the last 10 minutes. They're still going to be on full attack, and as we saw in that Shimizu game where we lost it in the last few minutes, it is a risky way to play, but definitely the results have come, I think, on average. And so everybody's very happy, like the my merry band of foreign supporters and English speaking supporters, we're all happy, but the whole of the supporter base is behind Angie, and he's very popular. I don't think I've seen such a popular manager in all of my time, but given the past few managers, that's not really hard. Everybody really loves him, and it's just a very great time to be watching the football there.
Indeed, indeed. And Stuart, you've inadvertently spoiled my upcoming quiz question by your mention of that loss to Shimizu. I was going to try and get both of you to guess who was the last team to shut out Yokohama to win to nil against them. It was, as you've mentioned, Shimizu 1-0 at the Nissan Stadium in match day 21. Shimizu, of course, by far, on paper, the worst defence in J1, having let up 66 goals in 31 games. And, yes, they were the last team to beat Yokohama to nil. But anyway, before we move on, Stuart, did you and your merry band get any word that this extension for Ange might be on the cards, or were you are there usually that many pro Ange flags in the home end? Because I saw on Twitter you'd obviously posted a photo of a number of people with. Yes. I'm not sure if they're all members of your group or just members of the away. The home end who had brought along Ange flags are all kind of gathered together for a group photo. But there certainly seemed to be a large number of them.
Actually, that group photo was organised by one of the ladies, and she knows that I have a flag, and one of my friends a couple of weeks ago, Kenji, he asked me to make a flag from my maker in China, so that just arrived, and I was able to display that before he got his hands on it. So she arranged that, just said everybody who's got the Ange flag, because there's the people with the flags and the people with the masks and things like that. And they're all there on a regular basis at Nissan Stadium. But they're very much far spread apart. So, you know, you would lose them in the crowd, but just getting everybody there, there was about 20 people joined in, and, you know, some people were holding other people's flags. So it was all like a little, pre-planned event, so that really, you know, set off, and that was totally coincidental. And I think it was more that, you know, while we have a chance at Mitazawa, where everybody's you know, kind of milling about the stadium in a kind of close proximity, let's get everybody together and take a picture, because we've been promising to do that for a couple of matches. We had no actual word, though. I think we'd heard that it was like it was more safe. I think I'm not sure whether that was something that was said here a few weeks ago or just something that had gone around. But it seemed that it was lessened. The chance of him leaving was lessened.
All right, and there was while we're on the topic of Ange Postecoglou, and yes, him re-signing for next season is terrific for all F Marinos supporters, and indeed anybody who is a neutral following the J League, because F Marinos have been a terrific entertainment. Through both of his seasons in charge, last season as well, of course. There was an interesting moment, a very nice moment at the full time whistle, Scott, where the managers gathered, Ange Postecoglou and Misha Petrovic of Sapporo gathered for the post-match handshake, and between three different languages and two different translators, the message was conveyed from Ange to Misha to say that Misha's words before the game actually meant more to Ange than the victory. And I'm sure, he might have gone on to say, and your goalkeeper being rubbish actually meant more than your words before the game. But anyway, do we have any idea? You have your finger on the pulse at F Marinos, Scott. Do you have any idea what Misha might have said to Ange beforehand?
No, I'm going to disappoint you and say no, I don't. Unfortunately, I'll find out for you though, and I'll let you know on the next podcast. But I just want to echo Stuart's thoughts. I think this is it's a great thing, not just for Yokohama, but it's a great thing for Japanese football that Ange is staying, because I can tell you in the middle of the year he wasn't going to stay. He was definitely gone. And then results started to turn. A few discussions were had, and I'm sure a couple of extra yen on the new contract didn't hurt things either. And all's well. From what I understand, you know, he feels he's in a real position to go on and leave a real legacy for Japanese football. There was definitely interest, both within Japan and elsewhere in Asia and in Europe as well. But barring some sort of catastrophic meltdown, the club's going to be in the ACL next year, which is a huge thing as well, which I think with the way that they play, certainly Yokohama are going to be a very good chance of having real success in that tournament as well. So, there's obviously, you know, still a few little issues, around certain elements of the club that I think need to be kind of tidied up going into next year. But the fact that You've got, the fact that you've got a guy like Ange, for a new contract is a brilliant thing. So I will tell you, though, what I do know about the question you just asked me, though. So, yeah, apparently Petrovic was really pleased with the football that Ange played, and he made a note of that pre-match that was done kind of respectfully and not out in the open. And Ange got wind of that, and that was apparently the result of their conversation at the end of the match. So there you go. I did find out for you what happened. So I think the challenge now for Marinos is going to be keeping all the support staff in place at the club as well, because a lot of those people have worked closely with Ange for a long time. So if Ange stays and the kind of team that he's got around him all stay on as well, I think there's certainly a chance for Marinos to really improve. I think they've already changed the face of Japanese football, and I think the good thing from what I can sense about the Marinos supporters is that it's not just a reading of the results, because we've seen many we're seeing a case with the current league leaders at the moment where they're playing pretty rubbish football and they're top of the league, and that can lead to, in my opinion, the misplaced conception that the coach is doing the best thing by the club in the long term rather than the short term. We've talked about that endlessly. I don't think that's happening at Tokyo, but it's certainly happening at Marinos, where Ange could stay for another 2-3 years, really continue to establish this identity, pass control on to someone else with the same philosophy and the same qualities. Although it's very hard to find someone at that level, and then this can become a Marinos football. One of my great joys in life is listening to Ange's post and pre-match press conferences, where, to the great frustration of interviewers up and down the country, he basically just repeats the same mantra over and over and over, no matter what the question is. But it's worth understanding it, because they have a philosophy, they have a way that they play, and they impose themselves on games. So you don't need to ask at the start of every goddamn match, Team X or Team A has this kind of style. What problems do they present to you? Because it's irrelevant. If you're, I've said it a billion times as well, what he's doing is so hard to craft and so hard to execute. You and me, or the three of us, could get together and have Tokyo playing the way that they're playing, because it's tactically simplistic to set up and execute. But the way that Ange has got this team playing is something altogether magical. And I would be saying, and I did, because I said it repeatedly last year, whether they're, whether they're 18th, whether they're 12th, whether they're winning the ACL next year, what is important is that an identity is being created. And eventually, when you have such a good craftsman in charge, and with Ange in recent interviews with the Australian press has said this as well, it took a long time for the Japanese players to see what he was doing, because they're kind of stuck in this system of not wanting to take risks, of not wanting to express themselves on the pitch, because it's not necessarily a part of culture. As we know, football is a reflection of culture. So to get the players to really accept and be able to execute the methods that he comes with, and let's not forget that these are the methods that he's had, right back to his time, with South Melbourne 20 years ago, going to the Club World Cup and having success there through, various club teams in Australia, World Cups, winning an Asian Cup. This philosophy that this team is playing with is something that's been nurtured and honed over 25 years, of playing, and then certainly throughout his coaching career as well. So it's just such a rare treat for Japanese football fans to be exposed to what I think is one of the top three or four coaches in the world. Certainly his staff are excellent as well. They might be going on to bigger and brighter things, some of them as well, which would also be great for other teams perhaps in Japan to have an exposure to that as well. So I think it's what this team is doing is really game shifting in Asian football, and let's hope it comes down to that last day where we have a reactive team playing against a proactive one, and we'll see what kind of football wins out.
Well, yes, indeed. They could hardly have had more contrasting results and indeed performances on this past Saturday. You're both taking all 3 points and both moving above Kashima. But yes, your point is very well made, Scott. Ange Postecoglou has done a terrific amount of work in just under 2 seasons' time. And, yes, you may well be proved right with your predictions throughout last season that he would get F. Marino's the title in 2019. Stuart, so, yeah, I mean, you're well and truly on the record as being a pro Ange, and you're very much enjoying the football that he's got your side playing. They're on a run of 4 straight wins, 8 games unbeaten, and they're now, of course, second, a point behind FC Tokyo. When FC Tokyo's run of 8 straight on the road began, F. Marino's trailed the Gasmen by 9 points. And so, yes, you've made up a heck of a lot of ground. And there are just 3 games remaining then. A trip to Matsumoto coming up after the international break. That could hardly be a more contrasting game, at least when it comes to Scott's frame of mind. Of course, the Matsumoto have eked out home draws against FC Tokyo and Kashima in the past month or 6 weeks, but obviously F. Marinos will present a completely different thing for Matsumoto to take into account. And then it is, of course, the Kanagawa Derby away at Kawasaki. You head back to Todoroki in the second to last game before hosting FC Tokyo on the final day. So, yeah, let's get a bit of a status check about how you're feeling with 3 games to go, Stuart. Obviously, you're coming off a high of this 4-2 victory, but you're within touching distance of another league title. I'm sure you're loving life at the moment, and how's it feel to be this close?
Well, my thoughts are buzzing around now. There's so many things that can happen in the next few weeks. For Matsumoto, obviously, if we don't beat them, then we probably don't deserve the title, because you have to knock out those teams that are kind of struggling. You know, have to really get past those. And I think Kashima will be kicking themselves still about that match. And so I know that many Marinos fans are going. Like, you can't get a ticket now. There's people who want an extra ticket to go to that match and are desperately searching for that one. I won't be watching that one. I'll be watching that one in Yokohama in the bar. Todoroki too. Again, right now our main focus within the supporters is tickets go on sale. I think Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, the site will crash for sure. So everybody will get a maximum number of tickets, and then if you have friends, you'll get a ticket. So that's the way that one is going to play out. And it couldn't be a better run-in with playing the leaders, who we probably will be the leaders at the very last match. And Kawasaki, the one before, again, that's a real needle match. Everybody loves to go to Todoroki, so we'll be really looking forward to that one. But yes, it's a difficult final 2 matches, and it's definitely going to go down to the last one. And I think there was a banner that I think I saw that we won every match at every league match at Mitsuzawa this year. So that's been very good for us. And I think the Rugby World Cup, it didn't play out that it was so bad for us in the end. I think it looks okay. You know, everybody's looking fairly fit. And the international break is another little rest. So that'll be good. But yes, it's exciting times coming up, and I'm looking forward to the last couple of matches.
Absolutely. All right. Well, phenomenal season up to this point for Yokohama, and we will wait and see how it all pans out in the final 3 match days. Stuart, once again, terrific to get your thoughts on everything F Monday notes. And there you go. Scott's come through with us with what Misha said to Ange before the game, so we can both sleep easy tonight. We were both very curious about what might have been said, but from Serbian into Japanese and then Japanese into English. We know what was said in return at the end of the game, so a very nice exchange between the two managers. All right, yeah, well, Stuart, I'm sure we'll be catching up again before the end of the season, so yes, enjoy it all, and we'll speak soon.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right, then, after another quick hit of music, Scott and I will wrap up the rest of the games from J1 Match Day 31. Okay, five games left to wrap up the rest of the Match Day 31 slate. As we work our way down the table, Cerezo Osaka's 1-0 home win over Shonan also has an impact, of course, on the relegation dogfight as Belmare continue to struggle. It was Hiroaki Okuno who got the only goal of this game 5 minutes into the second half as Cerezo continue on their impressive end to the season, and they actually rose a spot in the table to fifth after this win. I guess we're segueing on to the relegation dogfight now, Scott, so we can give Cerezo their kudos, but we'll move on to Shonan. Any signs of life here with three games to go? They're on such a long winless run, but at least the stats-wise, they were a little bit brighter here.
We shouldn't totally gloss over Cerezo, because of course if Kashima win the Emperor's Cup, then that will mean that fourth place in the league gets the ACL spot as well. So there's a few teams still in the mix for that. That's of course Kawasaki on 57 at the moment. So Cerezo, and they play an extra game than Cerezo have as well, and they're 4 points back. So there's still some form of a chance for them and Hiroshima. I don't know if particularly they want to get into the ACL or not, but it's a question for another day. But coming on to Shonan, I think it's what, six or seven kind of straight defeats now. They're an absolute free fall after what happened with Cho. This new guy looks like some sort of geography teacher or whatever that's come in and not really done anything to improve the situation. It's just as bad or going backwards. I'm missing a few players here. Sugiyoko was out. He's probably arguably their best player. Our old mate from Tokyo in goal, Akimoto, was dropped. Finally, there was a couple of other kind of selection moves as well. Yamazaki, who's been a main front, started on the bench. Maybe they played a little bit more positively than they have. The squad's fairly limited to start with. So if you lose a player like Sugiyoko, who is, in my opinion, easily their most important player, you're going to be up against it, then... it's just a real kind of impression of throwing, kind of darts all over the shop and hoping that a couple of them stick with some of these moves that they made. A guy like, Ibuski coming in and pretending to be a J1 footballer. I don't know if that's the answer either. They're in an absolute a complete freefall, whether it's of their own making. Some of the supporters, I'm sure, will point at the J-League, what went on with Cho, why that took so long. Cho, of course, could have responded to that right at the start of this inquiry, whenever it began in the middle of summer, and said, look, I'm standing down. Look at things next year, but we don't want to get in the way of things this year. He didn't do that. The club didn't force him to do it. So the whole situation has been really messily handled, and this is the outcome of it. Yeah, where they're in an absolute freefall. Having said all of that, it's not beyond the pale that you can see them turning things around after the break and going and rolling FC Tokyo. Stranger things have happened. They're now a completely desperate side. You wouldn't think that there's a way that they're going to get out of it. Three matches to go, a 4-point gap to S-Pulse and Tosu in the places above them. You probably wouldn't also think that Jubilo are going to reel off three straight wins. Who knows? But so Belmari, I kind of get the impression now that they've almost resigned themselves to maybe thinking that they have to play for this playoff spot, but the form that they're in, with so much jockeying in J2 as well, with teams winning here and drawing there and losing there, I don't know if they would necessarily roll whoever the third team is that gets involved in that playoff. So Yeah, it's a shame that, you know, this, in many ways, it was a situation of their own making that's led to, that's led them to where they are now. But, the good thing for me is, Tosu are 4 points clear, Ben. And that means that, we're going to settle very shortly that one of our pre-season bets.
Indeed, indeed. But I'm not sure if you were listening last week or maybe a couple of weeks ago, Scott.
Yeah, I heard your pro-rated argument, but Seanan didn't get injured.
Mm. All right. Well, yeah, it's in the hands of my lawyers as we speak. But, yes, Tosu did win one of the remaining relegation dogfight six-pointers on the slate at home against Matsumoto on Sunday. So, yeah, this was a double hammer blow for me, Scott. Obviously, Tosu moving 4 points clear of Seanan, but also knocking off my my merry bunch of green battlers, Matsumoto Yamaga, who had the chance to move above Tosu in the table, but unfortunately were, pretty dire for the duration here. And it was Takashi Kanai who scored the only goal of the game, heading in a Yuji Ono free kick in the 13th minute. That came 9 minutes after Ono actually had the ball in the net himself, but the goal was wiped off for a supposed handball during some pinball wizard in the build-up. So, Tosu, I can't argue, were worthy winners, at least from the highlights, on the afternoon. And, that gives them some breathing space, Scott. And, so Matsumoto are, left down in 17th spot. But this was obviously a huge relegation dogfight six-pointer. And the only one left on the slate is Seanan Matsumoto on the final day of the season, or I should put it in the correct order, Matsumoto at home hosting Seanan Belmare. The form that these two are in, it's hard to see, the second relegation spot not riding on that match on the final day. So between now and then, as we mentioned, FC Tokyo host Seanan in match day 32. Belmare then host Hiroshima in their final home game of the season before travelling to the all-win. Matsumoto host Yokohama, then travel to Gunma Osaka before they entertain Belmare on the last day. So, it's pretty much odds on that those two will battle it out for 16th and 17th in the table on the final day. So we shall see how that goes. But anything to add on the Tosu Matsumoto game? As I say, the poor old Yamaga, it just wasn't their day. And Tosu deserved winners and edging away from the relegation zone.
Yeah, and we've spoken about this before as well, but it's been really positive. The real catalyst for this turnaround was the departure of Torres,
right,
who was a giant weight on this team. Kim's come in, kind of got them together, and when there wasn't all this media palaver going on and all this hoopla, around Torres announcing his retirement months in advance and all that whole circus of crap that went together with that, they've been a really much improved team and one of the more lively teams to watch actually over the kind of final third of the season. Here they got the goal that they needed and then just sat back and controlled things. This Matsumoto, they were missing Cuenca here as well, it's worth noting, but Matsumoto were once again without Serginho, without Machida. They've sold their best players in mid-season, and they're a truly diabolical side coach by the Magnet Man himself, who was up to his usual tricks here. And this is why I kept coming back to what you were saying at the start of the season, battling and scrapping for points here and there. If they weren't doing that, if they were doing what Oita had done, maybe they might be in a similar situation and already be safe by now. But with Magnet Man in charge, that's not going to be the way that they play. And on paper their form hasn't, not form, but their results haven't been bad. They only lost one. This was their first loss, I think, in five matches. They struggle to score. They struggle to create things. And, they've seemed to come into the season with this mentality. If they can, somehow scrap together 32 kind of a draws, that might be enough to secure their survival. That's not my idea of a good time. So, yeah, that could come down to that last match. And, yeah, let's see how it goes. But hopefully, again, you know, football will be the winner on the day. And, yeah, Magnet Man will be taking his stack of tricks down to J2.
Yeah, I mean, I can't argue with the stat. It's at 19 goals scored in 31 games. So, yeah, it's been pretty dire for the Yamaga fans, who, as we know, are always phenomenal in their support of their club. And yes, they do deserve better. I don't deny that. All right, well, there's three games to go. Two clubs who are breathing a lot easier in the relegation dogfight after home wins in match day 31 are Sendai and Nagoya. Yes, Nagoya, Grant, has actually won a game of football.
Yeah, but
I was going to... I haven't seen the whole game, but I mean the stats are Kobe 15 shots to 5, but Nagoya have scored.
They had four shots on target.
And they've
scored
3 goals.
Oh my lord!
So yeah, Massimo Ficcadenti magic.
Oh yeah, it was a Ficcadenti special. He's dropped their two best players, in my opinion, in Schmidt and Gabriel for the second straight week. They've had 4 shots on target and they've bloody ended up winning 3-0. It was, it was an injustice against the game of football.
it's hauled them all the way up to 12th. And they sit just a point behind Vegalta now, who rose themselves after their 2-0 home win over Shimizu. That, almost certainly ensures that they will be playing in J1 in 2020. So that's another prediction that I've got wrong. Likely runner-up for a player of the year, Kunimitsu Sekiguchi got the opener for Vegalta in the 20th minute with a Yasuhiro Hiraoka scoring in the 48th. Nagoya, what a story that was. They finally won a game of football, but have hardly deserved a loss more. Naoki Maeda scored a brace, though, so fair play to him. Ryuji Izumi got the other goal for Grampus. Now, Kobe, we know, are safe up in 10th, Scott, but Shimizu, do you fear for them at all? As we mentioned by far the worst defence in J1, I guess, like the teams above them, they're probably just going to rely on the fact that Shonan and Matsumoto just aren't capable of winning two more games, and they'll probably be safe.
Yeah, probably so. They've lost 4 straight now. S-Pulse, so there's certainly questions that I'm hearing around the future of their coach going in to next year with a possible change coming there, which could be good if a more attack-minded coach was able to come into that squad with some of the young talent that they have, and they do have some very good, particularly in the attacking areas of the pitch, some very lively kind of players. So that could be a positive for them going into next year, assuming they get there. But yeah, as we said, if it wasn't for the real rabble below them, you know, you think they're in trouble. Reds are certainly in trouble as well. But can we see Shonan getting the? Well, I can't see Matsumoto doing it. So I only think it can be Shonan getting the 2 wins that they would need to put pressure on those sides above them. Probably not. But who knows? It's the J League, right? So strange things have happened. But of that kind of collection of clubs, Ficcadenti will probably have enough to eke out another draw or something and keep Nagoya safe. Reds are still in trouble. S-Pulse are definitely still in trouble. I think Tosu are good enough to get a point or two to make sure that they're safe. So, yeah, I mean, you would have to say that it's going to be a battle for 16th and 17th, but maybe Shonan can do something. I don't know. Maybe the fact that now it really is desperation stakes. They have to attack. They have to win. We've already seen him make some, brave and bold kind of selection calls. It didn't work. You know, you could probably expect off the back of a 2-week break even more of those. So, who knows? I mean, for me, I think Shonan are the wild card, and if they were to get those 2 wins, then if I was an Uro or a Shimizu supporter, I'd be getting somewhat nervy.
Most definitely. All right, there is one more game for us to very quickly review, but before we do, just to wrap everything up down in the relegation dogfight. So we're basically considering Gamba, who we're going to talk about in just a second, in 9th, Vissel and Vegalta, all on 38 points, safe. That's down to 11th in the table. Vegalta, the worst off of those three on goal difference. So Nagoya and Urawa have 36 points, and Reds, of course, have played a game more. Tosu and Shimizu have 35. Shonan, 31 in the playoff place. Matsumoto in the first automatic relegation spot on 30. And Iwata have 25 with three games left. So the best that Iwata could do is run the table and win three straight games and finish in 16th. But they cannot finish at any higher than that. And, yes, it's, yeah, it's going to be interesting. And it could all, that final automatic relegation spot could come down to that clash between Matsumoto and Shonan and the last day. As we've mentioned, you mentioned previously, Scott, just a few minutes ago, Oita and the terrific season they've had. Well, they continue to play musical chairs with the Sapporo for seventh spot in the table. It was Oita's turn to take it back this week after a 2-1 home win over Gamba Osaka. Takashi Usami gave Gamba an early lead, but Kazushi Mitsuhira equalised shortly before half-time. And then Tomoki Iwata continued his excellent season with the winner.
He's a good player, right?
Very good. With his, I think his fourth of the season. Oh, don't quote me on that, though. In the 64th minute. So, that's the one of the only games in the round, Scott, that really didn't have any bearing on anything at all on either end of the table. But, yet another feather in the cap of Trinita. They've taken down pretty much all of the J-League, traditional J-League heavyweights this season. And considering how, it's a different regime, but how utterly rubbish they were the last time they're in J1. I mean, to be seventh with the three games to go is just phenomenal. And we've said it all throughout the season. So, fair play to them and well done.
Yeah, absolutely. For a team that has pretty much been in beach mode for the last month, I'm pretty sure that they didn't want to be anywhere near the ACL spots. I think that became increasingly clear when they didn't really invest in the squad, mid-season. When if they had, they could have really kicked on and made a run of it. It certainly it looks apparent that they didn't want to finish up there and be burdened by the ACL next year. We've heard Katana Saka say consistently throughout the season, even when it was abundantly clear that they were safe, that their only goal is to be safe, that, every time they had a loss to a team, that it was a learning experience playing against higher quality opponents and da-da-da, all this, and at the end of it, they could end up as, it seems that they probably will, either seventh or eighth. So it's been a fantastic season. The story here once again is Gamba and really how poor. I mean, they controlled this match for the first 25-30 minutes, had a couple of chances, got a goal, went ahead, and then basically were completely outplayed for the next hour or so. And given the resources that he has available, given the fact that they do have this feeder team for now down in J3 and some exceptional young talent, for Gamba to be sitting where they are in ninth and at the end of the season, who knows, they could end up in 15th. I mean, it's 3 points the gap from ninth down to 15th. So it's very tight. And, really, they've been one of the great disappointments of the season again. They're in this complicated situation because you've got a legend of the club who was long touted as the man in waiting to take over as the coach of the team. I'm not sure that he's really met to the expectations that if I was running the club, you would have had for him. And I'm not totally sure that he's the guy to take them forward. I mean, I think if you had... I think if you had a better coach with this the quality of the squad that they've got, they should absolutely be up in the mix, for a top three or four finish. So it's been a very disappointing season for Gamba, and I think there's big questions that really need to be asked over the future of Miyamoto.
All right, yeah. Alan Gibson was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and obviously he was positive about Miyamoto, but I think I asked him whether we might be in the same situation next season, because it's 2 years in a row now where Gamba have had to dig themselves out of a pretty ordinary situation throughout the course of the year. So whether Miyamoto is indeed the right man remains to be seen. This is obviously his first senior coaching role of a top flight team. Anyway, he had been in charge of the Gamba under 23s, of course, but. It is a sticky situation, as you say, a legend of the club, and if they make the decision to move him on, that certainly would not be popular with the supporters. But whether that would be in the best interest of the club, it remains to be seen. But Gumbus currently sitting in ninth. And, there's a bit of a logjam of teams, as you say, around them. So that is all of the games from Match Day 31 rounded up. But keeping in mind, of course, that Hiroshima Urawa was played the previous Tuesday. That was one of the games that, Reds played before the ACL final first leg took place. And, we're now coming into an international break, Scott. Japan will play a World Cup qualifier against Kyrgyzstan and then a friendly against Venezuela. Slightly split squads from Hajime Moriyasu and I believe a total of 32 players called up for duty. Some will play in both of those squads and some only one. There are some players from the J-League who probably deserve a mention in their moment in the sun for their first call-ups, but I don't have the list in front of me, and to be honest, a total of 32 names can't really be bothered.
Take it up, Zay, read it off.
Also, there's under 22 games we played as well, so there's other players being funneled into that squad. So we'll just wish Japan all the best in all of the games that they'll be taking part in their new home kit. Scott, have you seen it? And have you managed to get it out of your mind? Has it been keeping you up at night? It's pretty horrid.
Yeah, we've lived through this in Australia though with that vomit shirt. Whenever that was, 20 years ago, that was a pretty bad one. But just a couple of names that I think are probably worth mentioning from the J League contingent that have been called up. One player I've been really impressed with is Ryosuke Shindo, the Sapporo defender, 23-year-old. So it's great to see him in the squad. And of course, it's long overdue that Kyogo Furuhashi has made it as well. So I think, a couple of exciting young guys, a few of the, kind of puzzling selections that we've seen. But, those two in particular, I think, are really positive ones, and they could be important parts of the future of the Japanese national team.
Indeed. Shindo's selection will make Sam Robson very happy. And, Stuart Smith and his Gifu gang will be very pleased to see their ex-FC Gifu man Furuhashi make it. Of course, this currently plying his trade with Kobe. All right, then. Well, that was a...
I thought you were going to ask me about the key selection in this.
Oh, no.
I'm disappointed.
No, sorry. I've dropped the ball there. Who should I be asking about?
Yeah, one of the goalkeepers.
Ah, yes, of course. No, I did think of you. But I didn't think.
Yes.
I didn't think
he'd
get any time on the pitch, though, so I didn't really think it was worth mentioning Kosuke Nakamura.
Well, he's been picked in the B team instead of the bloody A. That's a mistake to start with, but the boy is back.
Indeed, that will have cheered you up, I'm sure, Scott. All right, well, it was a terrific performance by you to see off three other guests. You did such a terrific job on the intro. Do you want to handle the outro as well?
Yeah, okay. That is all that we have time for today. But my thanks once again to Stuart Woodward, to Alex Bishop, to Ryan Steele, to the always enigmatic Benjamin Maxwell. That is all that we have time for today. And, of course, not to forget the most important people to thank, and that is you, for listening. And remember to download and subscribe to the podcast across all the various podcasting mediums. It's been a fantastic journey through all the world of Japanese football, and we'll be back again. I don't know when we'll be back again because there is an international break, but we may have something around that. We may not. I have to consult my schedule planner for that. But until then, it's thanks for listening, and bye
boom,
for now.
Boom, bada boom, boom, boom.
The J Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.